Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, actor John Lithgow tells us about his long apprenticeship in the art his father did not want him to pursue.
So I told him, good news, Dad, I'm gonna audition for a Fulbright to study acting. And his face fell as if I had told him I had a terminal disease.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Op-ed columnist Joan O'Sara takes us inside the world of Ron Suskind's confidence men.
Suskind basically is willing to say flat out that from a management and leadership point of view, he was quote-unquote not ready to be president, which is a really kind of a shocking thing to hear.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news.
John Lithgow was one of America's most celebrated actors and also a prolific and fine author. His new book is called Drama, An Actor's Education. It's reviewed for us this week by Ada Calhoun, who says Drama is a brisk book packed with funny stories and tremendously entertaining. I'm delighted that John Lithgow is here to talk about it. Welcome.
So nice to be here. Thank you, Sam.
Okay, so you say acting is storytelling. What do you mean?
I guess an actor is a part of a large machine of storytelling. You play characters, but basically you're unfolding a story for an audience. An actor is sort of on the inside of that story and helping bring it to life. And sort of late in my life, I've made storytelling into a sort of adjunct of acting in plays.
And for you, it began at an extremely early age. You're from Yellow Springs, Ohio, right?
That's right.
Antioch College.
That's right. My dad was on the faculty there.
And you started acting very young. And he was very serious. Shakespeare, you learned early.
He created Shakespeare festivals in Ohio all through my young years, four of them in all. One of them, the Great Lakes Theater Festival in Cleveland, is still going on. Mm-hmm. And it was just part of our lives. Antioch was the first of them and a long, sustained one in which he produced every single one of Shakespeare's plays. The first line of the book proper is, I started acting before I even remember.
Then you went to Harvard, mm-hmm. and you say in the book this was actually the most creative time in your life. Why? Mm-hmm. When were you there, in the 60s?
I was there between 63 and 67. Interestingly, when I went to Harvard, I wasn't interested in being an actor.
You wanted to be an artist.
My creative ambition was to be an artist, to be a painter and a printmaker. And that fell by the wayside almost immediately because I sort of fell in with a theater gang at Harvard, which is always has been, by tradition, tremendously active, engaged, and very talented, even though nobody goes there to study acting. Because by osmosis, I was already a very experienced actor. I just became the campus star almost immediately. Literally within a week of arriving at Harvard, I was cast in a major role on the main stage of the Lowell Drama Center.
So that was the point when you realized this is what you were going to do.
Yeah. My second year at Harvard, I was spending more time doing plays, directing operas, designing sets for ballets, just working in everything that came along, I would try it.
Then you went off to London in an equally exciting time. Mm-hmm. It was London in the 60s.
Yeah, but it was just the opposite. London was tremendously rigorous academic training. They sort of thrashed us, but in a very good way. I mean, it was terrific training.
John, you grew up in a theater family. Your father encouraged you, yet when you told him you'd be going to London to study acting, he was flabbergasted.
Yeah, well, he didn't encourage me, but he didn't discourage me either. We never even addressed the subject. He never figured, nor I never figured, that I would actually become an actor. And when I decided to audition and apply for a Fulbright to go to England, it took him completely by surprise. It was a measure of how oblivious he was about what was really going on with me.
But you also say how innocent, naive you were.
Exactly. It was a sort of dual misperception of each other. So I told him, good news, Dad, I'm going to audition for a Fulbright to study acting. And his face fell as if I had told him I had a terminal disease. And at that moment, I realized how difficult the business had been for him. I think until then I had sort of seen him as this kind of, I think I describe it in the book as an insouciant ringmaster. You know, he was a theater director who seemed to so completely enjoy what he was doing. It's an incredibly difficult profession. And on that occasion, he sort of told me just exactly what I was signing on for if I did this, how hard it is to sustain a family, to make money and sort of thrive and prosper, how unpredictable, how you have to make very good friends with rejection and failure and disappointment. And he made this astonishing suggestion. He said, why not business school? And it was like a suggestion from Mars.
And did he even really mean that?
He did. He said on that occasion, he admitted to feeling very inept as a manager and making budgets, personnel issues. He said, you could learn this. You could acquire this. He always regretted that he hadn't learned administrative skills. Mm-hmm. And I just thought this was the craziest suggestion I'd ever heard. I wanted to be an artiste.
And in some way, did that steal you and your resolve? I mean, it's kind of the classic thing. Dad says no. And
I don't think I was defiant. I just ignored the advice. I just went ahead and did what I was planning to do.
Yeah.
P.S., within a year, he was hiring me, you know, not only to act but to direct and design for him.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you something very different that made you the envy of me and all my male colleagues at the Book Review. You had an involvement with the singular Liv Ullmann.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Well,
why you?
Why me? Well, I was cast opposite her in a very passionate play, Anna Christie, a play that has begat, for example, the marriage of Liam Neeson and Natasha Richardson, you know. Great O'Neill play about Anna Christie, the prostitute, and Matt Burke, the Irish coal stoker, who meet in a shipwreck. She saves him. He falls madly in love with her. I fell madly in love with Liv. Of course, I was already in love with Liv, as obviously you were too back in those days. My entire long chapter on that chapter of my life is a chapter about the volatile chemicals of acting. I mean, the fact that you put your emotions to work, that can lead to very intense emotional involvements almost in spite of yourself.
And just so our listeners are reassured, you're also the author of seven or eight children's books.
Yes.
And when did that begin? And why?
Well, there's a chapter in the book about that, and it's a chapter about my baby sister, Sarah Jane, who is 10 years younger than I. There are three of us siblings older than Sarah Jane, so she sort of grew up with two real parents and three sibling parents, and I was the closest to her in age. So when my older siblings took off for school, it was Sarah Jane and me in the household, and I was her constant babysitter, kind of best pal. When I was 15 or so and she was 5, or I was 16 and she was 6, I entertained her. Mm. I adored her. I still adore her. That was the beginnings of entertaining children. When my own children came along, I was already writing songs and playing the guitar for kids. I started performing concerts for school benefits and in their classrooms. Before you knew it, I was a kids entertainer and really loved doing it. This was concurrently with my the beginnings of my career as an actor. And it's such an incredibly fun thing to do. Kids audiences are so astonishingly responsive. They're difficult audiences, but they're very, very exciting.
As much today as they were generations
ago. Oh, yeah. Well, kids don't change. Right. And I write about that in great detail in the book, the whole phenomenon of suspension of disbelief. That's what you seek as an actor in front of an adult audience, but you never attain it. An adult audience always knows you're pretending. Kids lose all track of that. They barely even remember they're in a theater. They are so engaged. And I just love that.
John, at one point in the book, you mentioned some of the really gifted actors you work with and do so with the understanding that readers may not recognize some of these names now. How much luck is involved in having a long, sustained career like yours?
Well, there's a lot of luck involved. You know, the acting profession is so much of the moment as the sort of act of entertaining is. It really only exists while it's happening. And then, poof, it's gone like a will-o'-the-wisp. The more an actor can sort of accommodate himself to the truth that he will eventually be forgotten, the better off he is. Because you can't live everything I do. You have to savor the fact that what we do is like electricity. It crackles and then it's gone. It lives on in memory for a while, but not long.
Even film performances?
Yeah. Films are not the same. Yeah, you feel, oh, good, film is immortal. It goes on forever. But how many people really sit and watch TCM to see the great performances from 1935? I remember an appalling moment working with my dear young protege, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, when we were both on Third Rock from the Sun. He's now a major movie star. God bless him. Deserves everything that comes his way. Us older actors were chatting and mentioned Cary Grant, and he said, "Who's Cary Grant?"
No.
And my heart just
sank. He really didn't know.
And this was a very sophisticated 15-year-old kid who knew, who, as far as I was concerned, knew everything. And he was asking me, "Who is Cary Grant?"
Well, we know who you are, John Lithgow.
For the moment.
Thanks so much. That was John Lithgow, whose new book, Drama, An Actor's Education, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, tablets, e-readers, price wars, what's going on?
Well, for many months now, we've expected Amazon to make a big announcement about their next e-reader, and they finally did. This week, they announced that they were introducing a new tablet, which will go up against the iPad and all of the other tablets out there. They also said that they're introducing new Kindles, which will be priced as low as $79, which is breaking a new price barrier for e-readers.
So one assumes then the competition for the e-reader reader is really heating up. Is this like the big deal going on in publishing now?
It is. I mean, it certainly got the attention of the publishing industry yesterday. When Jeff Bezos speaks, they listen. Sometimes they don't like what he's saying. But this will definitely put a lot more pressure on Barnes & Noble, which is really the a major player in the e-reader market. You couldn't have said that 2 years ago, but now they have a pretty significant chunk of e-book sales.
How is Barnes & Noble down this? They do it through the Nook, is that right?
That's right. Barnes & Noble introduced their first e-reader a couple of years ago, and it's become much more popular in the last year, especially. They introduced a new black and white Nook, which is the update to their original Nook, and the newer one has a touch screen. They also have a Nook Color, which is very good for reading ebooks with color, picture books, cookbooks, and magazines.
Julie, I have to ask you this. Do you get to try out all this stuff? Have you used all these different readers and compared them? Is that part of your job?
It is my job, actually. I have a dazzling array of e-readers on my desk.
And have they really gotten better over time? I mean, is it kind of like all the other electronic equipment that gets both cooler and cheaper?
They have. I mean, I'm no David Pogue, but I can tell you that they have become more sophisticated and more accessible over time. I mean, the original Nook from Barnes & Noble was really buggy, and there were, you know, constant software updates. And, you know, when you look at the original Kindle, which, by the way, cost like $400 when it first came out, you know, the new one is much sleeker and much more sophisticated, even though it's still a really basic black and white e-reader, where when you press the button to turn the page, the page disappears for a second. And that was really one of the things that Barnes & Noble touted about its new Nook, which is that it was a lot smoother, and when you read it, you didn't see those words disappear for as long as they did in the previous Nook or on the Kindle. The iPad is, of course, a totally different device, and it's a different experience than reading a book on a basic black and white e-reader. But we do know that a lot of people really prefer this simple black and white e-reader because it is most like reading a book and it's most convenient.
I had lunch today, I don't mind admitting, with some librarians and people from the children's book world because we have an annual event here, the Book Review, where we choose the best illustrated books. And one of the questions that came up is how compatible all these different reading devices are. If Julie, you have a Nook, and I, Sam, have my Kindle, can I get the same books that you get? Or if I have a tablet instead, can I acquire the same books, just download them and read them? Or are these companies like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, which are in competition, kind of hoarding the material they have to force readers to go, you know, through their websites to get the material?
It depends who the publisher is. I mean, if it's a Random House book, you can get it from any retailer you want. It'll be the same book whether you buy it from Barnes & Noble to read on your Nook or Amazon to read on your Kindle. But Amazon is doing its own publishing programs. It started doing imprints several years ago, and it publishes a lot of content that is available exclusively in digital and exclusively from Amazon.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Ron Suskind's new book, Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President, is already getting a great deal of attention. And who better to write about it than the great Joe Nocera, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, who also knows everything about business, finance, and Washington. And he's here to talk about it. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Sam.
All right. So you say this is a groundbreaking book, or maybe. How come?
I do think it's a groundbreaking book because I think it's the first book that gets past the sheen of Obama. The first books, the John Alter book, the Remnick book, were basking in the afterglow of the election and saw him more sainted than not. This book is a much more tough-minded look at the way he approached the presidency, and in particularly economic policy, which has never been Obama's strength anyway. He really didn't come to the office knowing that much about it. And Suskind basically is willing to say flat out that from a management and leadership point of view, he was, quote unquote, not ready to be president, which is a really kind of a shocking thing to hear, even though at the point at which the book is being published, that has become, to a surprising degree, conventional wisdom among people who fervently supported him 2 years ago.
And what's the evidence Suskind has? Interviews?
He's done tons of interviews. And one of the things I admire about this book, as I say in the review, is that it's not all anonymous sources. And it's not all kind of blind, you are there, fly on the wall stuff. He actually does step out and ask people on the record about Obama. And he gets some pretty candid views from people like Christina Romer and Paul Volcker in particular. Those are the two that just stick out in my mind. But he has from others too, Peter Orszag and so on, that basically talk about the level of dysfunction among the economic policy team. And what's particularly disheartening is Obama's refusal to make a tough decision and even to see that as his job.
So what does he see as his job instead?
Most presidents, you have a group of A's saying, let's do X, and you have a group of A's saying, let's do Y, and they're diametrically opposed. The president's job is to pick X or Y. But according to Suskind, and I think he's pretty persuasive on this point, what the president would do is say, oh, come on, guys, figure this out. And he'd basically want them to split the difference or to come up with a policy that took some parts from X and some parts of Y and blended them together. And that's part of the reason why you didn't really have a serious jobs program until literally weeks ago. Because the aides were at loggerheads as to what would work, and he wasn't willing to say, let's do this.
Is there ever a time when that approach, sort of blending opposites, works? I mean, you hear stories about Franklin Roosevelt. He'd have two also opposed points of view presented to him, and he'd say, okay, the two of you put it in a one-page memo that combines everything. I mean, is it totally a wrong way to go about things?
The difference between Franklin Roosevelt and today is that Roosevelt both had congressional backing and an economy that was so dire that he could literally try anything and everything. So what he would do if confronted with X and Y is say, let's try X and Y and see what works. Obama has never been in that situation, and the country and the Congress won't allow for that situation. So you are put in this position of having to make tough decisions. The second thing Susskind does that I think is really quite devastating is he does get inside meetings with bankers, where the bankers take the measure of the man, and they come out saying, gee, we don't really have to worry about Obama. He talks a tough game to the public, but behind the scenes, he's really not going to do anything to us. So we don't have to worry. So we don't have to worry about cutting back our compensation. We don't have to worry about our capital ratios. We can just fight, and we're going to get what we want. And he's pretty devastating on that front, too.
And is this the way Obama was from the outset? Was he overwhelmed by the scale of the economic problem and didn't really know what to do? Was it a problem in the personnel, the staff, advisors he chose?
Susskind certainly makes a strong point that he picked the wrong group of advisors, particularly Larry Summers, to be his top economic policy advisor. And in effect, that job should be a job where he gives the president various alternatives in a neutral kind of way. But Summers has a strongly opinionated man, and he basically wants the president to do what he says. People felt like Summers was a roadblock to their ability to get their ideas in front of the president. And it really caused a lot of the dysfunction among the economic policy team. The second problem, I think, which Susskind doesn't make a big a deal out of, as I would have, is that he really did come to the presidency with an unformed idea of what economic policy was and how it worked. He has a source, Susskind does, from UBS, who was somebody who was talking to the president even before the crisis and basically saying, this is what's going to happen. So it's not like the president didn't know, didn't see it coming. And then, as you'll recall, during the campaign, it was Obama, during that famous meeting in the Bush White House, who acted statesmanlike as opposed to John McCain and gave people the illusion that he would come in as a cool-headed and wise economic figure. But that really hasn't been the case at all, and I do believe that's because he had very fully formed ideas about health care, he had very fully formed ideas about education, but he came to the presidency at a time when the economy should have been the most important thing for the country, and he didn't really have fully formed ideas, and he floundered a lot.
Where are we now? Some of these advisors, including Larry Summers, are gone or soon will be. Has Obama learned anything from this?
It seems like he has. Liberals may disagree with the idea of extending the Bush tax cuts, but Susskind praises the president for that because it's the first time he sort of realized, I have to take ownership of a decision. It may be unpopular. I can't split the difference. I just have to do it. I would say also that the jobs program is a good example of him standing up and saying, here's what we need to do, here's what the country needs, here's my program. The debt ceiling crisis, on the other hand, makes you wonder whether he has learned anything because that's another example of him trying to find consensus when there was really none to be found. And as I say in the review, Susskind ends the book on an optimistic note precisely because he has new aides, he has a new attitude, he seems to have a better feel for how to be president. But what I say is we have 13 months to find out whether that optimism is justified or not.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Joe Nocera, op-ed columnist for The New York Times, who this week reviews Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President by Ron Susskind. Jennifer Schuessler's here with Bestseller News. What's new on the list this week?
Well, we've got lots of new books. Once again, there is a new number one title on the fiction list. It is the latest thriller from Richard Castle. It's called Heat Rises, about an NYPD homicide detective who uncovers a conspiracy, can you believe it, that reaches the department's highest levels. Neal Stephenson, the great cyberpunk novelist, is also back with his sixth bestseller. It is at number four, and it is called, I think, Riemde, I don't know how to pronounce this word. It seems to be a play on ReadMe, and it is about a virus that invades a multiplayer online role-playing game and sets off a violent worldwide struggle.
And it takes some reading. Isn't this book enormously huge?
1,000 pages.
Oof.
Even longer than Chad Harbach's novel about America's former pastime before video games take over. The Art of Fielding, his very well-reviewed baseball novel, is at number 9 in its 3rd week. So hooray for literary fiction.
Excellent. What about nonfiction?
Jackie Kennedy still on top with her book, The Book of Conversations, between her and Arthur Schlesinger Jr. about John F. Kennedy. There are a lot of new books on the list, most of them quite serious and substantial, starting with Ron Suskind's latest book, Confidence Men, about the Obama economic team. That has been generating lots of headlines. It is at number 2. And then Daniel Yergin's latest sort of epic story about energy lands at number 4. It is called The Quest. And then at number 7, there's sort of a curious book by Candace Millard. It is called The Destiny of the Republic, and it is about the life and death of President James A. Garfield, who really wasn't killed so much by the assassin as by the doctors who were so incompetent in their treatment of him.
They just butchered him, didn't they?
Yeah, sticking their ungloved fingers into his wounds, that sort of thing.
Now, speaking of serious books, we've also got Stephen Greenblatt, don't we, quite amazingly?
Yes, the great Harvard literary scholar lands at number 13 with his latest book, The Swerve. You recall he had a big bestseller a few years ago with Will in the World, his biography of Shakespeare. And here, The Swerve is about a Renaissance book hunter who rediscovered Lucretius's classic, On the Nature of Things, and sort of kept it from disappearing. This is sort of a great book that we almost didn't get to read. So, you know, it's, I think On the Nature of Things is maybe not something that's on everybody's bedside table, but I wonder if now it's going to pop up on the paperback list. Who knows?
Well, Lucretius had a huge influence on Harold Bloom, as we know, who borrowed many of his terms from Lucretius's poem, and also our favorite John Updike cites him quite a lot in The Witches of Eastwick.
I did not know that.
And there is the extent of my Lucretian knowledge. Well, amid all this seriousness, what about Joe McGinnis and his new book, The Rogue?
It is on the list. It enters at number 10, probably a little bit lower than he and his publisher had hoped. Of course, this is his great, much-awaited Sarah Palin tell-all book. And, you know, he takes a lot of whacks at Palin, but as it turns out, he's the one who's been receiving all the blows. The press has been quite negative. Starting with Janet Maslin in the New York Times, who was very dismissive of the book, calling it full of sort of innuendo, badly sourced claims, and also just stuff that was old, stuff you could find, you know, via Google. You didn't have to move next door to Sarah Palin in Alaska like McGinnis did. You know, Sarah Palin herself, or at least her lawyer, sent a letter to McGinnis's publisher threatening to sue. And even Levi Johnston, hardly a fan of Sarah Palin, took time out from promoting his own anti-Palin book, Deer in the Headlights, to sort of reject McGinnis's suggestion that Palin had used cocaine. Probably Levi didn't think she was cool enough to use cocaine. But my favorite assessment of the book appeared on a kind of funny website called Christwire.org, which appears to be a kind of conservative political website with sort of extreme crazy Tea Party leanings. But on closer inspection, it's sort of an Onion-esque joke. And they ran this great takedown, which I think is possibly my favorite book review of the year. They call, you know, full of all sorts of colorful rhetoric. They dismiss McGinnis as the bastard child of Roald Dahl and Jackie Collins, and the entire journalistic tribe he represents as, I'm quoting here, polymorphously perverse alcoholics struggling with tyrannical egos and unpaid rent bills. Sounds about right, don't you think? The guy who wrote this, the sort of fake blogger who wrote this alleged review, also lays into McGinnis for his past books. He says that his book Fatal Vision slanders the Green Beret. Of course, it's about a Green Beret who actually murdered his family. And then he says that McGinnis even, you know, insulted horses in his book about horse racing, The Big Horse. He accused McGinnis of showing little respect for George Washington's men who depended on their fighting equines to bring liberty to a youthful nation, to the work animals that gloriously wrangled open the West to trade and Christendom, to the cavalry soldiers who led us to victory in World War I, and to the gracious beasts that to this day inflame many a young woman's heart with the hypnotic rhythm of their gait in the verdant pastures of America's heartland. Sam, we've got to sign this guy up to write some reviews for us.
And yet I have to say that review, so-called, of Joe McGinnis's book was emailed to me by none other than Joe McGinnis himself.
So he sort of read it as a rave, or what?
I don't know. I'll have to ask him. Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.